looks like most people are here. So, welcome to the last session. I felt like I just introduced the retreat and now it's farewell, but hopefully you've had a beneficial time here. You know, even the short time can be really helpful. So, not to undervalue even a weekend retreat. But the question always is, oh no, and I'm going to go out of the retreat center and go back to the big bad world out there. How to continue the practice? Well, I guess the trick is the practice isn't really different in essence, whether you're in a retreat center or outside. It's just maybe the supportive conditions of the retreat center are different. But the essence of the practice remains the same. So that's something that can make us feel more of a connection, that it's not just something we do when we come to a special place and, you know, have all these like talks or meditation cushions or, you know, in a particular, a whole particular like accessories for our practice. But our practice is really in our mind, in our body, in our speech. And we take that everywhere, here, there, everywhere, especially our mind. So I thought maybe I would recap a little bit, you know, some of the things I've said, but more applied to when you go back to your normal life. And I didn't go through it very much in detail, but because I figure most people already are leading an ethical life, you know. If you want to come on a retreat, you're probably already quite interested in spiritual practice and already, you know, have a you know, a strong sense of what is harmful and beneficial in terms of actions. But it does bear a little bit of remarking because sometimes people, because meditation is a bit more like esoteric, people focus more on that as kind of like the thing with Buddhist practice. But in the way the spiritual practice is laid out in the Buddhist path, it's a holistic training. It's not just a particular sort of like exercise you do with the mind. It's also leading an ethical life, leading a harmless life in the way you use your body and your speech. So those precepts about, you know, that I mentioned about not killing, not stealing, not having any sexual misconduct and not lying, not taking intoxicants, these support a life that doesn't cause harm to yourself and doesn't cause harm to others. And this principle is really important, not just not causing harm to others, but not causing harm to yourself. Because sometimes we forget that part. We're so concerned about not hurting others, but we don't realize that actually when we hurt others, it really hurts ourselves. And so that's the important, I guess, rule of thumb, whether you know the technicalities of the rules or not, or there are things that are not covered, strictly speaking, under these five headings, but you know, you can feel it causes your mind to become darker or heavier, then you know it's harmful. And any actions you do that cause the mind to be lighter or brighter, then you know, okay, that feels right. So that's something that we can develop a more intuitive sense of ethical behavior, ethical conduct. And that's really important for supporting the development of the mind, because you can't really be mindful when you're consumed with a sense of remorse or worry about actions you've done that have caused harm. It's natural that will cause disturbance in the mind. I mean, even people say hardened criminals, you know, they don't care, they have no remorse. It's not true. It's not true, because the nature of all of our human minds is that it's sensitive to when we do things that cause harm, and it disturbs the mind. It's just whether or not we have the opportunity to allow ourselves to feel that disturbance. That's the difference. Some people just cover over it, you know, with more aggression or just denial or whatever, but actually it's there. And that's why sometimes coming on retreat is difficult, because that stuff that you might have done, you know, comes back to you and comes up in your mind again. So if you just sit, you know, in perfect posture, it's not going to help really if your conduct needs to be purified. Because then when you sit in your perfect posture, you're sitting there ruminating and all the terrible things you've done. You know, it's like it just looks good, but it doesn't feel good. So that's really important to take care with our actions. And especially with speech, I mean, lying is the main one. But really, if you look at speech that's beneficial and not harmful, it's more refined than that. So it's avoiding speech that's divisive and avoiding speech that's harsh and avoiding speech that's like meaningless. That too, that one is the hard one to do, right? Because, you know, in normal conversation, I mean, how do you always talk about profound things? No. Or do you always talk about meaningful things? No. But even having a sense of purpose when you talk in a lighthearted way or jokingly, with some deeper purpose than just killing time, but maybe you want to cheer someone up or you want to create a sense of a friendship or a sort of social cohesion and that kind of thing, then there's still some element of you're doing it consciously with some beneficial intention behind it. And that makes your speech more valuable. It's not just filler, you know? It's not filling the airtime of your life. It's actually causing benefit in your life for yourself and also for other people. And speech that's used that way can be really such a gift in the world. It's such, if you've ever, you know, you remember some kind word someone has said to you or some wise advice you've gotten decades ago, you'll remember that and it will enrich your life forever. And some really mean word someone said to you, you know, at a time when you were vulnerable, you'll also remember that the rest of your life. So imagine how we affect other people in the short and long term with our speech. And that can help us to be more careful, not with a sense of goody-goody, you know, but with a sense of care for how our actions impact other people and ourselves. So these are things that, you know, we always have to work on, you know, in the retreat center otherwise. And even more, especially when we are not in retreat and noble silence, you know, no longer protected by noble silence, we do have to deal with other humans. And, oh, the tricky art of communication. It's just so hard to get it right. But to keep developing that skill and to realize that you can't always make everybody understand you, and miscommunication is just unavoidable. But at least what we can work on is our intention behind what we say, our intention in what we mean to convey. Whether it actually is received that way or not, we can't control that part. But at least we can work on the part where we speak with some sense of clarity, not just stuff popping out of our mouth on impulse, but some sense of why, what am I about to say and why? You know, having that split second pause in your mind to have some mindfulness in the way we speak. That's really important. And that actually helps to develop mindfulness. It's like this kind of like feedback loop. It's not just like suddenly you have this mindfulness first and then you can apply it to your life. But no, even keeping the precepts helps to strengthen our mindfulness. And it helps to strengthen the happiness in our mind, which again also strengthens the mindfulness. So these things support each other. And so when we come to our meditation practice with a mind that's, you know, reasonably undisturbed because we haven't really done anything we feel badly about, we haven't really said anything that we wish we hadn't, you know, when we come to sit, then it's easier for the mind to settle and to develop, you know, the more refined kind of mindfulness and the more refined kind of stillness of the mind. And that's something that I really, really encourage people to keep doing even outside of retreat. I know it's really difficult when it's like busy. I remember also when I was, you know, I was really busy when I was doing my studies. And I know this is different. So when I was doing my undergraduate studies, I felt my schoolwork was more important than meditation. Even though I knew meditation was helpful and was good, and, you know, sometimes I did it occasionally, I just felt like, no, it's more important that I, like, read these books or, like, write this paper. And that half an hour, that 10 minutes for meditation is, like, it's going to cut into my study time, and that's more important. So I could never find time to do it. But by the time I was in graduate school, I had done more meditation, and I really was convinced of its value. And I, you know, when you go on a retreat and you really experience some silence in your mind or something that is so, so precious and beautiful, you don't want it to just dissolve and, like, you know, wane away, that you want to keep up the practice. That's when I was able to really stick to a 1-hour-a-day practice and sometimes twice a day. Not because of some gritting my teeth or like, oh, I'm going to be like, you know, have lots of discipline. But because I just, it was just such a shame to see it all wither away so quickly, you know, the peace that you had developed on retreat. You're like, oh, please let me maintain this a little longer. And when you get into a habit of it, you just feel something's missing when you don't. You kind of feel you can't sort of, it's like if you haven't brushed your teeth for a day or you haven't taken a shower or something, you know, you just feel kind of dirty. And the mind is like that. Once you start meditating regularly, you feel like all that stuff that happens during the day, if you haven't processed it by being able to sit quietly for some time and just at least let it air, let it come out, just process it, you feel kind of like your mind is kind of dirty. You know, it feels kind of grungy in there. And so it feels uncomfortable. And so then there's more motivation for you to keep up some kind of daily practice. And depending on what's feasible in your life, like I said last night, I think it's more important that consistency is there than quantity. That I think in the long run, it makes more of a difference if you just keep at it every day, a little bit every day, rather than having these like spurts of more intensive meditation, you know, here and there sporadically. It's best if you can do both, of course, but, you know, but if after the retreat you just drop it for the rest of the year, then you have to like come back to square one and even behind, you know, even a few steps, you know, behind square one when next time you come. And it's just kind of a shame, you know. You know, it's like all the effort you put in, it doesn't really gain momentum. So if you really see the value, you will find the time. You just will. It's not really about what you've got on your plate. It's about how you prioritize what's on your plate. So yeah, see if you can. Well, I guess, you know, it's up to you. It's like if you find it important, you'll end up doing it. So I guess I don't really have to say anything. But I do find that it was very helpful to keep up a daily practice. But even that daily sitting itself is not enough. It's that whole, the rest of the day, you know, being able to come back to the present moment. At least sometimes, you know, what's the hardest thing about being none? Maybe that, like coming back to the present moment, like more and more frequently and more like in like closer intervals, you know, having the gaps of like lost in thought narrow and shorten. And that's a really takes a lot of time to develop that. I mean, I'm still developing that. And that's something but it really pays off. You really do see, over the years of practice, you really do see that it does happen. You do feel your mindfulness is getting some traction in the rest of your day, that you do have your moments of coming back. And that practice that I was talking about yesterday morning, about feeling your body, you know, especially when emotions come up, that's really helpful in your daily life. That's really something that you can use in a natural way, you know, not like in some like, oh, randomly I'm gonna walk really slowly, you know, or something, but something you can naturally integrate. When things happen, when you're talking to somebody and they say something that you're just kind of like, it causes some, whether it's irritation or offense or confusion or something, you know, before you just say something back to them, you can feel it in your body first. How does that make you feel? You know, and if you feel that tightness wherever you feel it, and to just be able to relax to that tightness and open to that tightness, that gives you a way to not just be manipulated by what people say to you and just be forced to react in your habitual ways. This is something that gives you some sense of strength, some sense of pause, some sense of being able to step back from the situation. And also to not be just pushed and pulled by your emotions. And also not to be scared of them, like I said, to be able to experience them in your daily life. And that way you get more familiar with them. When you start experiencing your more distressing emotions on a more regular basis, it's just like, oh, it becomes like, oh, that one again, you know, and then it's not so threatening to you, and then it becomes something that you kind of just are able to be with them, and that's something that causes also less wanting. You know, when you notice that when you have this sense of I want things to be different or I want something I don't have, there is a tightness in your body somewhere, some kind of contraction, and when you can open to that and relax with that, then that actually resolves the problem. And the thing you know you drop the wanting naturally. So that's another way that this really benefits, you know, the path as a whole. Because if wanting is the main problem, then anything that helps us to kind of, you know, subdue and reduce our very compelling wants is really helpful on the path. So this is something that is not only just related to emotions, but in general, being back in your body, having mindfulness with your body, is something that the Buddha said there was like all these many benefits. There's a sutta where there's like so many like lists of all these benefits leading to full enlightenment, etc., etc. But the one thing I'll just highlight is that he said it helps to prevent unwholesome mind states that have not arisen from arising, and for the wholesome mind states that have arisen to be able to develop to full, you know, development. So mindfulness of the body is like, it's like a really good one to master. And it's something that, you know, it's very practical, it's very concrete. Any time in your day, you can always come back to your body, whether it's your posture or, you know, the sensations in your body or just your breath. It's something that's always there for you. I mean, as long as you're alive, you have your body. So it's always something that can be your refuge and your anchor. So developing familiarity and skill with directing mindfulness to your body is something that is a very, very helpful and beneficial aid for you in being able to maintain mindfulness, but also to develop all sorts of wholesome states in your mind. So that's why I really feel like sometimes people think, oh, body sweeping, that's kind of just a baby meditation or something. You know, that's not really like the sophisticated real deal. But I really think it's a genuinely, genuinely helpful and legitimate form of practice. And that if you can be with your body more mindfully than be with your breath and just be distracted, then it feels like it's more helpful and efficient to just have a meditation object that you can actually focus your mind on. So if your mind isn't ready to be with the breath, then be with your body and do the body sweeping. And, you know, and that will just naturally inform your daily life. You'll be able to more naturally just come back to your body and notice the sensations of your body because you've practiced it so much. And that's really helpful for maintaining the mental balance, because when you are able to be sort of equanimous or open or receptive to your bodily sensations, naturally you're less swayed by your emotions. So this is something you can really see the difference. Sometimes when people go on retreats and they might experience some really special deep states or stillness or something like that, but when they go out back into their life and they somehow it falls apart, quite it's very fragile. Because if you don't have all the supportive conditions to allow for these rarefied states of meditation to happen, they're going to fall apart. And if you don't have sort of the in-between kind of practices that help ground you, then it's almost like less meaningful or helpful to have all these deep states. So mindfulness of the body and being able to be aware of your bodily sensations is something that is the bridge that can really help you, you know, to maintain a sense of balance and equanimity and joy and happiness in your daily life in a more consistent way. So, it's also like something you can work on even if you're very busy. So even if you're very busy, you still have to go to the toilet, right? So I remember when I used to work in an office, you had to walk. It was like you had to walk a little bit, like maybe a good 5 minutes, 7 minutes, something like that, to get to the bathroom. So when you're walking back to your cubicle, it's like 14 minutes. So every time I went to the toilet, you know, that was an opportunity to try to walk mindfully, you know, and then do your business and then hopefully do that mindfully too, and then, you know, come walk back mindfully. Not that I always did it, but at least when I remembered to do it, that was an opportunity built into my day without any effort that I could do. You know, so you can pick things like that, pick like you're brushing your teeth or you know, whatever it is that you do on a regular basis, and try to make that your little exercise of, oh, can I do this mindfully and a bit more slowly or a bit more carefully, and then you can work with those kinds of things. So that's also something helpful. And another trick I kind of have been playing around with is based on another article or something I read about some kind of, I think it was an study about measuring people's levels of happiness. And they found that people who were happier had a more, like, they asked two questions, like, you know, try to notice in your day if what you're doing and what you're thinking about align. Like, if you're doing something and you're thinking about something else, people who are like that tend to be less happy, this study found. I thought, oh, that's really intriguing. And so I tried doing that, you know, throughout my day. Just pause every, whenever I notice that, like, I might not be thinking, you know, just ask myself, what am I doing? And notice, what is it I'm thinking about? And it's like, oh, yeah, I'm not thinking about what I'm doing. And just even just noticing that thinking about the other thing just drops away. And you find out, actually, you don't even have to think about what you're doing. Because if you're really with what you're doing, you don't really think about it. You know, you just do it. That's when you know you're really mindful in the moment, is when you're just doing it and you're not like analyzing about it, planning the next step, da 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 da. You know, when you're really just doing it, as they say, in the zone. So that's a good check. You know, that will betray whenever you've lost your mindfulness, is when it's like, what am I doing and what am I thinking about? When what am I thinking about is like way unrelated to what you're doing. Then you're like, oh. And that itself means you've got mindfulness back. So it's not about just remembering that you've forgotten is already like mindfulness. It's not like you have to do anything extra. You know, you just remember that what you're back. You're back to what it is you're doing. And so that's kind of makes it a bit more fun and also a bit more practical. Sometimes it's like really hard to tell yourself, oh, be mindful all day long, you know, and then you actually do it. You can, you know, it's so like random and like abstract. Like, yeah, I'd like to do it, but how? But this gives you a little bridge to like how you can actually make that happen a bit more often. So you see if it works for you. I mean, maybe not work for everybody, but you can try. So those are some little bits and pieces that I was thinking I would share that I found helpful for myself. And the other thing that, you know, I thought a little bit more about this idea of trust. And I only mentioned like one aspect of it yesterday, which was trusting your mind. But I feel there's importantly also to trust in the path, you know, to trust that the path works. And we see that when we see people who have apparently, I mean, they for all, what can we know if we're not enlightened? But, you know, there's some people, you know, who you feel like they've got a something special to them that isn't like normal. Like, you know, it's like there's a sense of calm or selflessness or humility or, you know, this some sense of they're not really troubled by all the stuff that troubles us. You know, something like that. So you feel like you see examples of people who practice this path and seem to get some results that seem worthwhile. So that starts to seed you with some trust and faith in the path. But also when you see in your own life, you know, we always think about the next step and the thing we haven't gotten yet. Like, I want to get deeper meditation. I want to get more consistent mindfulness. I want to always be doing, not thinking about what I'm, you know, yeah, doing and that kind of thing. And all that kind of thing. And then you're thinking about what we haven't gotten yet. But it's really refreshing to look back sometimes and think about how far we've come, you know, in your own practice, in your own life. How is it that you feel that you have a bit more like centeredness, or how you have a bit more ability to think of other people's perspective on something, or you're able to to not take things so personally sometimes. I mean, even you still do, but you know, not always. Maybe there's a reduction in how often you're triggered and that kind of thing. Or even when things do upset you, maybe the length of time it upsets you has shortened, and you can kind of get over it, maybe not in a week, but maybe in a few days, maybe in, you know, a day or whatever. And so things like that, these are also indications that your practice is working and the path is working, and that the path does work, that it's foolproof, it's idiot-proof, no one, you know. Like, I don't think you're so special. It's not like you can mess it up. Like, it's something that if you just practice consistently, it starts to bear fruit for everybody, you know, no exceptions. And to trust in that, trust in your own capacity as a human being, like any other human being, that we have this capacity to awaken and to end our suffering. We do, you know. It may not feel like that sometimes when we're in the thick of our suffering, but to know when the fact that we have reduced it indicates, sort of pointing us in the direction that it can go further than that, and that you can really, you know, get over the whole lot eventually. But it will take time. It'll take time. And, you know, got to give yourself that time plus extra, because it's never going to be, your progress is never as fast as you imagine. We all have these very grand fantasies, you know, delusions of grandeur that, oh, you know, so naive. When I first became a nun, you know, I was like, I think I came on like, I wasn't my first, yeah, as a nun, my first 9-day retreat here, you know. It's like, oh, it's Jhana Grove, you know, the name is Jhana Grove. And so you're like, oh, so obviously you get jhanas when you come to Jhana Grove, you know. But like, so I was kind of like, oh, well, you know, oh, it's only day 3, never mind, I've still got time. Day 7, it's okay. Hey, day 8, day 9, wait, you know, like, where is the living up to the name thing? And then I'm like, dude, it's like 9-day retreat. What do you expect? It takes lifetimes, people. It takes a long time. So, yeah, but, you know, secretly you still kind of think that, oh, but maybe this one, maybe this time, maybe it's been enough lifetimes, who knows. But you know what? Don't think, like, forget, it's not helpful. I mean, it's very hard, because everything else in our life, we have targets and we have times and we have 5-year plans and whatever. But it's just every time you have the urge to like think in that way or have that paradigm, you'll over time you'll realize it's just not helpful and it's not realistic. And who cares? Because if you really are in the present moment, whenever you are, not that you will be always, but whenever you are, you do feel free. You do have that experience of freedom. And so you've touched it in a small way, so you know it exists. So then keep coming back to that. And then, you know, over time it develops momentum. So to really have trust and faith in ourselves and the path, that's really, really, really key. You know, I had this moment when I thought, well, maybe, you know, the reason why people don't get enlightened is because they think they can't. It's not the technique or what they're doing wrong in their practice. It may be deep down, it's because you don't think you can. You think not yet, or, you know, maybe in a few eons or whatever, you know, but you have the sense that, like, it's something out of your league. And so that's something that, yeah, well, if you think that way, we'll be out of your league, right? So it's like we make our world. Our capacities and our limitations are self-made. So this is something that it's like, partly you can try to cultivate a sense of trust in yourself, but partly it comes when you see fruits in your practice little by little. So that's just an encouragement. That's an encouragement for myself as well. And that's something that, yeah, it's like, it's helpful to encourage also your friends in the Dharma whenever you feel that, you know, you discuss practice and they're like, oh, I have no progress, this, that, whatever. You can tell them how you have noticed their progress, because we can notice other people's progress better than they can notice their own, you know. And so if you ever have that type of conversation with any of your Dharma friends, you know, then please point out how you see their progress, because that really actually is true, and that might give them a different perspective on that. So That relates maybe to the final thing that I might bring up, because I noticed in the interviews, but also in some of the questions last night, there's just, you know, things related to the topic of judgment or you know, a bit of taking things personally. Just this whole big topic of sort of self-doubt or lack of appreciation of oneself, which is kind of, I would call that the pandemic, actually. That is sort of rampant in our world, you know? And in a way, that's good. It means you're not alone, if you've ever felt that way. But in a way, it's kind of shocking that you know, it's just so widespread. And that's something that it's really, I think, some people say you can start the way around where you have metta to other people first, or loving kindness to other people first, and then you might develop it for yourself. But people are different, but I feel in my own experience, I feel like you can't really have genuine loving kindness to someone else if you don't have it for yourself. It's like, then it's almost like, why do the other people deserve loving kindness if you can't give it to yourself? Are you somehow better than them in some way that you deserve some supreme loving kindness and they can get the second rate kind or something? It's like, it's a bit weird. And so I've focused a lot, you know, over the years, because I was very self-critical too, you know, I still am, but you know, less. And it's, I can see that when one learns to appreciate oneself more, and it's not even appreciation in this like, oh, yay, look at all your good qualities, but appreciating even all your flaws and all the, like I was saying, all that it means to be human, to appreciate that that's what makes us who we are, and that's how we learn, and that's how we develop. And also, I mean, oh, who can stand a perfect person? I mean, honestly, like, they're kind of, they don't seem real, you know? And they make you feel really bad because you feel completely inadequate next to them, right? But also, like, honestly, what, like, a really perfect is, there's something about it that's actually not very approachable, not even very comforting or something that seems real. So flaws, what is it? The dress makes the man, or whatever was it? You know, clothes make the man, flaws make the human. So it's really what makes us lovable, actually, you know? I took this fiction writing class when I was in university, and one thing about what the writing instructor said that has stayed with me that I found so interesting, he said that when you're like, you know, developing characters in a story and you're sort of like, you know, describing them, this and that, he said, you know what? People who look beautiful are not the people who have completely regular features. Like, beautiful looking people are people who have something a bit, like the nose is a bit too long or the eyes are a bit too wide set. There's like something about them that is like very like intriguing and special and unique, you know? And that's the difference between people who are pretty and people who are beautiful. I mean, pretty is like Barbie doll. It's like you can mass produce them. They all look the same, and they're completely like scientifically, there's some algorithm of how eyes are, wider eyes are, and how small her nose is, and you know. But you know, don't knock Barbie. She teaches metta meditation now, apparently, on Barbie vlogs. Look it up. But the thing is, beautiful people have something odd about them, you know, something that's a bit like not regular. And so that's the same with us. You know, what makes us intriguing and fascinating and like fun to be with and unique is the things that are a bit weird about us, you know? It's a bit odd about us. And so that is to be appreciated. Genuinely, not in some like weird like pop psychology way, but genuinely, like, to embrace all of it that makes you you. You know, there's nobody who's going to be just like you. And if there were, you'd be freaked out, man. Who wants to hang out with like an exact carbon copy of yourself? Then you'd see how weird you were. But you know, it's, the thing is, we are. And to be able to embrace the whole gamut of emotions and you know, good qualities and weird qualities and, you know, mistakes and just things we wish we hadn't done, wish we hadn't said, but already did, already said, all these things, to be able to open to them and to embrace them as something unique and worthwhile. And to be able to do that for oneself makes it possible to do that for other people naturally. It's not like you have to be like, oh, well, I'm so kind now that I'll be able to put up with this very aggravating person or that obnoxious man. And, you know, it's not like that. It's when you see your own obnoxiousness and you see your own aggravatingness and you see your own, like, irritatingness, and you're like, well, but, you know, what can you do? You know, when you can do that for yourself, it's much easier. And naturally, you can do it for other people because you see yourself in them. You can sympathize with them. You can empathize with them. And you don't think you're better than them or they're better than you. It's kind of like, oh, we are human, huh? We're like this. You know, you have your brand of human and I have my brand of my human, but you see underneath it, there is something there you recognize. And so you can kind of be like, okay, you know? And so that's really something that makes loving kindness something real in your life. It's not just some ideal, you know, it's something that can actually genuinely come from your heart, and you can genuinely open your heart more and more. And of course, there will always be people who it's a bit difficult to open your heart to, you know, let's be honest, but that's part of it, and that's okay. You know, that's also not something for you to, like, rag on yourself about. There are, we have frequencies. Some people aren't on our frequency, so when we're with them, it's not comfortable. It doesn't make them a bad person. It doesn't make you a bad person to feel uncomfortable with them. It's just we are on different frequencies. But I guess when you see people who have really very, very well-developed loving kindness, and you see how they're able to be at ease with anybody, that's because with practice, your frequency bandwidth increases. And, you know, you're able to feel at ease with more and more different kinds of people because you see the commonality in all of them. And you also understand, you know, that nobody can control who they are, what they do. It's like all these conditions that create our behavior. So the more people can be to have that understanding, then their bandwidth increases. And so that, even if we're not there, that points us to a, you know, some kind of sign that this is possible, and this is, and if you're being able to open more and more, it means, like, if you just keep at it, you will, and it'll be, your heart will be like 360 degrees open, and you can really, really just be able to allow stuff to come in, you know, people stuff, emotional stuff, thought stuff, whatever stuff that happens in your life. You're able to more and more let it come in, and then not let it burden you too. Let it come in, let it go out, and that's the ideal. So I guess surprisingly, I ended up talking a little bit on the theme of opening your heart. So maybe that's a good place to end. Yeah, to keep maybe that as one of the ways we understand our practice or what we wish to develop in our life is an opening of our heart and an opening to life. So we can just keep working at it at our own pace, each one of us. And I really, you know, feel very glad to have had this chance to spend this time with you. And the people I talked to yesterday, you know, in the interviews, I was really inspired and gladdened to see people who are so genuinely interested in the spiritual path, you know, whatever spiritual path it may be. It doesn't have to be the Buddhist spiritual path, but in some, they have some sense of wishing to grow spiritually. And that's something that is a really beautiful thing to see in other people. And also beautiful to see in ourselves. I mean, why are we here? We're all interested in this. So that's something that is very inspiring. So it's been, you know, really wonderful spending this time with all of you. And hopefully we can run into each other again somehow on the path. So maybe that's enough talking for now. But I wanted to close with doing some loving kindness meditation or metta meditation. So you can take a moment to stand up and stretch your legs and get comfortable. And then we can maybe do a nice little metta meditation. Okay. Again, just start with getting yourself into a comfy posture. If you already are, great. If you aren't, then adjust as you need. Stable and balanced. Upright but relaxed. Open chest, open heart. Hands and feet in a comfortable position. Head balanced. And relaxing your face. And just feeling a sense of relaxation wash over you from head to toe. Relaxing any tension in your mind. Letting go of any thoughts that are floating around. When you feel a bit more settled, try imagining yourself when you were a child. Whatever age. But an image of yourself when you were a lovable child, adorable little one. Any child is adorable. You notice that? You can bring up a picture. Maybe you can remember from your family album or something. Just an image of when you were a small little being. Innocent, and not a care in the world. And then see if you can bring to mind someone that you feel in your life has really loved you. Unconditionally, who has only your welfare at heart, wants only the best for you, whatever that may be. May not be perfect, but someone in your life that you feel has loved you. So it could be a parent, a teacher, a friend, And when you can feel a genuine sense of love and warmth from. And sort of bring to mind how they made you feel. That sense of love you felt from them. That sense of embrace and safety, acceptance and care. Try to channel it. And imagine feeling that for yourself. Here I am, little me. There may be some things about myself that I'm not terribly proud of or find a bit embarrassing. The mistakes I've made that I regret. But that's not something this person would ever hold against me. So imagine you give that to yourself, not holding it against yourself. Think of the way they might look at you with delight to see you, or laugh because they think you're funny in a good way, or enjoy being in your company. And again, imagine feeling that for yourself. That you also appreciate your company. Love hanging out with yourself. Let that warmth fill your heart. Bring it into your heart. So that little child that you were, looking back, just a baby or a 2-year-old, would you judge that child for anything it did? Probably not. So that's like you right now. No different. Just bigger, taller, more hair. Do you have to judge yourself for things that you've done? So when you think of yourself now as an adult, you feel any sense of judgment towards yourself? Just try to channel that sense of love for that child and apply it to yourself now. Apply that sense of love from your parent or teacher or your friend. Apply it to yourself now. or from the warmth in your heart, feeling it spread to the rest of your body, expanding in your chest, moving up to your shoulders, your face, washing over your head, down your neck and your back, down your arms, down your legs, filling your body with some warmth, brightness, sense of ease, sense of acceptance with who you are, how you are right now. Yeah, this is good enough too. If you feel any resistance, you don't feel it's quite real, that's okay. Just feel as much as you can. Sense of acceptance, at ease with who you are, how you are right now. And then we can think of other people in this room, people sitting next to you, behind you, in front of you, fellow travelers on the path we shared this space with, maybe pass them in the halls, sat next to them at lunch. Maybe we haven't talked to each other much, we shared something very special, which is practicing on this path together. So offering them the same sense of warmth and acceptance and care. So we go our separate ways now. But may you be well and happy, each and every one of you. May you continue on this path and keep seeing the fruits of your practice little by little. And extending it out, our warmth, our care, our loving kindness to all the other people in the retreat center who've helped support this retreat, like Anusha, the organizer, Christina and Scotty, the caretakers, anyone else who has helped in some way, people who brought us food, extending out, wishing them well, wishing them peace, wishing them joy. And then further out, across the street, the Bodhinyana Monastery, Ajahn Brahm, all the monks there, many of whom helped build this place, whose teachings support the practice here. Extending out even further now to Perth, the whole city, the areas around it. May they too have a chance to experience some peace and joy in their life. Be safe and happy and well. And then extending to Gichiganap, where Dhammasara Nuns Monastery is. Wishing all the nuns there well, to grow in their practice, to develop deep wisdom, wide compassion, so they can share it again with all of you, here and elsewhere. And extending further to all of Australia, so wishing all the beings, not just humans, all the beings all over this large, beautiful country, may they be well, at peace, safe, and happy. And opening wider and farther to other parts of the world, to Asia, especially India, or places suffering terribly from COVID. May we offer what we can, which is our peace, our happiness, our well wishes, our sense of support and friendship, even though we're far away. So may all the beings who are suffering terribly be relieved of their suffering. And may any suffering they experience help them to grow on the spiritual path. And then extending all over the world with a special thought in our minds for all the people affected by great hardship, whether it's from the pandemic or from political strife, whatever it may be. May any peace or joy or light in our minds somehow reach them. Somehow lighten their burden. Lighten their heaviness. And help to reduce their suffering. And now just imagining spreading this happiness, this light, this warmth all over the universe. You can even imagine it. It's all around you, in every direction, without any exceptions, without any gaps. Just Just extending it out like the sun and its rays that touches everything and everyone. They're really giving it everything you've got. The wishing from the bottom of your hearts that all beings, including ourselves, be truly well and happy. Be completely free of all suffering. To live with total ease, and to be fully, truly, deeply liberated. Dwelling in this for just a moment more. And then bringing it back into our hearts. Taking away the warmth and the love and the kindness. We're bringing back that sense of light back into our heart. So we can bring that with us when we leave here. Nurture it, keep it safe. So it'll be available to us in times of self-doubt, in times of conflict with others, in times of uncertainty in our lives, as a resource and a strength. The feeling, that warm glow in your heart, tucking it away safely, settling back into your body. Rejoicing, a marvelous 3 days where we have put earnest and genuine effort and interest into spiritual practice. So rejoicing in that. Be encouraged to keep going, keep at it. We're coming to the end of the meditation. I will ring the bell 3 times so you can gently come out of your meditation as you listen to the bell. So that's the end of the formal part of the program, but I think you still have some time to do your own meditation before lunch or whatever else you want to do, clean up or whatever. So So thank you again for sharing this time with me. It's been really a joy for me. And wishing you all the very best in your practice, in your life. And, you know, maybe next time we'll see each other again here. Or whatever that may be. So all the best.